Chapter 30, Letting My Id Run Amok. It didn't take long for me and Franny to establish a routine in Washington. I'd walk home from my office to the little house we had rented on Capitol Hill, Franny found it on Craigslist, where, during a quick but always delicious dinner prepared by Franny, we would discuss each other's days and muse about our hopes and dreams for our children, our country, and the world. But mainly I would complain about how much work I had to do. You see, after dinner, I would go to my den to do my homework. Mainly that's reading. Every night I'd go home from the office with a binder. Inside the binder is a schedule for the next day, usually loaded up with a wide variety of meetings, along with briefings for each one, so I know what I'm talking about when I sit down with those labor leaders or those activists for Alzheimer's research, or some guy wants to pitch a new postage stamp honoring Danish pianist Victor Borge. How did that guy get a meeting with the senator? Staff error. That's my binder. Well, it's one of them, the daily binder. In addition to that one, I have a binder for each hearing I'm going to attend the next day. One thing I didn't know before I got to the Senate is that witnesses customarily submit testimony in writing before the hearing itself, which means we senators get to read it the night before we question them. Not long after the press conference, where I stupidly gave Drew credit for my idea on mandatory arbitration, Judiciary Committee Chairman Pat Leahy scheduled a hearing on the issue. At hearings, each side gets to invite witnesses. Not surprisingly, Republicans had invited a witness who would testify in support of mandatory arbitration agreements, a lawyer representing the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. The night before that hearing, I opened my judiciary binder and flipped directly to the testimony from the chamber stooge who's going to try to defend these indefensible agreements, a guy named Mark A. DiBernardo. A passage immediately caught my eye. The employee actually benefits from mandatory arbitration clauses, Mr. DiBernardo argued, because under arbitration, the employee prevails 63% of the time, compared to prevailing just 43% of the time in court. I thought. As a trained lie spotter, I had become intimately familiar with the right wing's most common techniques, including the deceptive use of statistics. And that one seemed downright suspect, especially since he used a very particular word like prevails. What exactly did that word mean in this context? I decided to dig a little deeper. In a footnote, DiBernardo had cited a source for his statistic, page 30 of a Congressional Research Service study. I called my Judiciary Committee staffer and asked him to track down the study so I could take a closer look. He found the study. It was only 10 pages long. Kind of hard to analyze a statistic that appears on page 30 of a 10-page report. The next morning, I woke up with a song in my heart and adrenaline in my blood. I took my seat at the end of the dais and waited patiently for my chance to question DiBernardo. Finally, it was my turn. Would a rape victim, I asked him, be deemed to have prevailed in an arbitration proceeding if she was awarded $50. DiBernardo started fumfering. Please answer yes or no, I instructed him. He paused uncomfortably. I say no. I had him. Okay, would a rape victim, under his definition of prevailing, be considered to have prevailed if she was awarded $100? You know, I think this is a distinction without a difference what we are talking about, but now I recognize the pivot when I saw one. Nice try. Answer yes or no, please, sir. He knew he was cooked. The question is, what is the number that counts as prevailing? I think that sort of is the question, isn't it? I said, trying not to flash my incisors. DiBernardo stammered a bit more before giving up. I don't know. Aha, so when you said no before, you didn't know whether that was true or not, did you? Well, did you? Did you? Did you? Okay, the last two did yous were silent. Now, I'll bet Mark A. DiBernardo is a good husband and father who just wants to provide for his family, by defending a corporation's right to heartlessly exploit its employees and rip off its customers. But I was enjoying this, perhaps a little too much. Truth be told, I recognized the feeling. It was the same feeling I had gotten back in the old days when I realized just how far up Liar's Creek Bill O'Reilly was, claiming he had won 2 Peabody Awards and then claiming he hadn't said that. I can't help it. I love getting these guys. But now, instead of simply exposing the mendacity of a right-wing lying liar, I was standing up for everyone who had been the victim of a mandatory arbitration clause. The family who had to go before an arbitrator chosen by the nursing home that had allowed Grandma to die of dehydration. The women employees who had been paid less than their male counterparts at Walmart, but couldn't file a class action lawsuit because the Supreme Court had decided in another 5-4 Roberts Court decision that they had to go into arbitration as individuals. Maybe I wasn't allowed to be funny anymore, but I could still let my id out once in a while by eviscerating some right-wing jerk. "It's not enough for you to kill these guys," Mandy Grunwald observed after one such evisceration. "You have to set them on fire." Would you like another example? I bet you would, and I would love to relive it. As I mentioned in the powwow chapter, I made it onto the Indian Affairs Committee in the face of some stiff competition from no one. One day we were considering an amendment to the Indian Health Care Improvement Act that would allow dental therapists to provide oral health care to American Indian and Alaska Native children in woefully underserved Indian country. Children in Indian country have twice the rate of tooth decay as the general population. 68% have untreated cavities. 1 in 3 report missing school because of dental problems. More than 50 developed countries outside the United States have a licensed trade called dental therapist, mid-level oral health providers whose scope of practice is somewhere between a dental hygienist and a dentist. Guess who doesn't like that idea? Dentists. In 2006, the American Dental Association opposed, unsuccessfully, an experimental program that paid for Alaska Natives to train as dental therapists in New Zealand and then return home to provide oral health care to isolated Alaskan villages, many of which are accessible only by air and which would receive dental care just once a year when a dentist would fly in and stay for all of a week. The Alaska experiment had been successful. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski, a Republican who had co-sponsored the Indian Dental Therapist Amendment with me, invited one of the dental therapists from Alaska to testify about the difference it made for kids to have an adult from their own village reminding them to brush every day and to take care of their cavities. And a pediatric dentist from Minneapolis testified that peer-reviewed studies showed that dental therapists improve access, reduce costs, and provide excellent quality of care. But the American Dental Association didn't want the competition from dental therapists, and so they opposed our amendment. They sent their president, Dr. Ronald Tankersley, to testify against it. The night before the hearing, there I was with my binder, reading his testimony, getting that old familiar feeling as my LIDAR began to tingle. "This year alone," he was planning to say the next day, "there will be 70 additional dentists providing care in tribal areas. With one more year of similar recruiting success, the shortage of dentists in IHS, Indian Health Services, could actually be eliminated." That couldn't be right, I thought. I called my staffer on Indian Affairs and asked for some real data. How many dentists are there in Indian country? What's the shortfall? What's the attrition rate? He called back a few minutes later. Here was my end of that conversation. Oh, man, this is going to be fun. The next day, after Dr. Tankersley read his testimony, I asked him, "Shouldn't everyone have access to dental care?" "We believe they should," he answered. I repeated back to him what he had said about the 70 new recruits this year and about how, If there was similar success the next year, the dentist shortage could actually be eliminated. Was that his testimony? Yes. Do you know how many dentists there are in the IHS? No, I don't. There are 600 dentists in the IHS. Do you know how much the shortfall is? Yes, the shortfall at this point is about another 70 dentists. No, it is not. The shortfall, I told him, was about 25% or around 150 dentists. And did he happen to know the rate of attrition? I don't know the statistics, he said, blanching a bit, but the turnover rate is high. So when you said that with one more year of similar recruiting success, the shortage of dentists in the IHS could be eliminated, why did you use the word could? Because there is no way we know that it will be eliminated. Why'd you even bother to say it? Because the turnover rate is about 30%. I did the math for him. The current shortfall was 150 dentists. Turnover would add another 180. That made a shortfall of 330. 70 new recruits would still leave Indian Country about 260 dentists short. I asked him again if he agreed that everyone should have dental care. We do. It doesn't seem to me, I said, that your testimony is convincing at all. And what I want to do is make sure that kids in Indian Country don't have rotting teeth. That is my responsibility. Of course, I have failed in that responsibility. Yes, our amendment passed, which means that dental therapists can serve in Indian Country, but only in the two states where dental therapists are licensed to practice at all, Alaska and Minnesota. Nine other states are now looking at licensing mid-level oral health providers. American Indians receive less than half per capita what we spend on health care for the average American. And that's a disgrace, one that even the most satisfying takedown can't eliminate. But at least that day I got my Indian name from a Minnesota Ojibwe friend of mine, yells at dentist. It's one thing to take on a professional association president who didn't prepare and doesn't know what he's talking about. It's way more fun to take on a right-wing ideologue from a conservative think tank. In 2011, Tom Harkin, chairman of the HELP committee, called a hearing to talk about how we can build and strengthen the middle class. There is a classic philosophical divide between the two parties on how the economy works and on the government's role in creating jobs. The night before the hearing, I read the testimony of Kenneth Green, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and the designated conservative on the panel. Green's written testimony ended with this sentence. In conclusion, the idea that the government can create jobs in the economy is a myth. The next day, I began my questioning by noting a few government projects that had created millions of jobs. Had Mr. Green heard of the Erie Canal? It opened European markets to Midwestern agricultural goods and timber and made New York the Empire State. The hearing itself, I noted, was being carried on C-SPAN, the cable satellite public affairs network. Was Mr. Green aware that the Defense Department had sent up the very first satellites? The hearing was also being streamed on the Internet. Did Mr. Green know that the Internet had been created by the government? How about rural electrification? The interstate highway system? Don't a lot of companies rely on the interstate highway system to ship their goods? And what about Mr. Green himself? His bio said that he had received his graduate degree from UCLA, a public university. Did any of his professors believe that they had jobs? Did any of them teach him anything? It would be absurd, Green finally admitted, to say that the government can't create jobs. I got in one last swing. When we receive testimony here in the United States Senate, I pointed out, we really like the testimony to say what it means and mean what it says. These hearings quickly emerged as one of my favorite parts of the job. The only problem was that there was a fine line between showing up a jerk and being one myself, between letting my id out and letting it run amok. And every so often, I'd go overboard. In 2011, we had a hearing in the HELP Committee to talk about chronic disease prevention. And one of the witnesses was a guy named Tevi Troy from the Hudson Institute, a right-wing think tank in Washington, who was there to complain about the Affordable Care Act. At one point, he was arguing that the ACA would force employers to drop health insurance for their workers because it would be cheaper to just pay the penalty than to pay for coverage. So I asked him about Massachusetts, where the reverse had happened under RomneyCare. The percentage of companies insuring their workers had actually gone up, the only state in the country where that had happened. He cited a statistic from a study in the Wall Street Journal that showed that AT&T, for example, spends about $2.2 billion annually on covering its workers, whereas it would have cost only $600 million to drop the coverage and pay the penalty instead. Of course, AT&T hadn't dropped coverage because offering health insurance makes you a more attractive place to work and also keeps your workforce healthier and more productive, which is why more companies had chosen to offer insurance in Massachusetts, not less, which was the entire point. There might have been an interesting argument to be had there, but I got a little sidetracked by the words Wall Street Journal. You see, the Journal has a serious and trusted newsroom, but its editorial division pumps out a steady stream of absurd piddle-paddle, and right-wing hacks love to borrow credibility from the news department to support the nonsense on the op-ed page. So anytime I hear someone cite it, I get a little suspicious. Did the Wall Street Journal, I asked the witness, have a study or an editorial? It was a statistic cited in the Wall Street Journal, he answered a little nervously. Oh, man. Cited where in the Wall Street Journal? It was on the editorial page, he stammered. I had him. On the editorial page. It was an op-ed. Okay, I said, it was an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. Yes. That's interesting, I said, or, if I'm being honest, smirked. The statistic remains accurate, he offered lamely. You know, I sneered. It's funny, the Wall Street Journal op-ed page, sometimes, I don't know if you know this, uses statistics in misleading ways. There was laughter in the room as the witness squirmed, but my healthcare staffer, Hannah Katch, quickly pushed a note in front of me. You're being an asshole. She was right. Not only was I focusing on the wrong thing, the editorial credibility of the Wall Street Journal, but I was badgering this poor guy. Immediately after the hearing, I thanked Hannah. Then I went straight to our office and called an all-staff meeting. Everyone piled into the conference room, wondering what this could be about. Hannah just handed me a note while I was questioning a witness, I said. I read the note aloud. Hannah did me an enormous favor. I don't want anyone in this office ever to be afraid to call me an asshole. Blank stares, a few nods. Okay, meeting over.